Stephen Hawking, spaceflight pioneer, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome, I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. You've heard all about Dr. Hawking's amazing life and his contributions to science over the last few weeks, but we've got the story of his adventure in weightlessness, direct from someone who was there with him as the great physicist experienced zero G. It's not just a great story, it's good news for anyone who hopes to slip the surly bonds of Earth and visit the final frontier. We'll also hear the reminiscences of Planetary Society co-founder Lou Friedman. Lou enjoyed Hawking's company many times, and we'll start with complimentary thoughts from the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the Science Guy. Bill, we find you in a Missouri hotel room this time. What are you doing out there?
I spoke at the University of Missouri. I'm reluctant to call it the greatest night of my life, but it was good. It was fun.
It was a good night. It was up there.
Yes.
A giant of science has passed away, and we'll be talking quite a bit about him on this week's program. You got to meet him.
Yes. Yeah, so in 2010, the Planetary Society gave Stephen Hawking the Cosmos Award, an award that we present only now and then to people that we feel are very worthy. And Stephen Hawking was among them, and he accepted, and we all went to Cambridge. By we all, several people from the board of directors went to Cambridge. You know, he had an unusual way of communicating with us with his electronic voice, but he's funny. He was very dry. The dry English wit was there. We all got caught up in his, if I may, aura, his Hawking radiation, and it was quite a night. It was just more about me, Matt. That was the night that the board pressured me to take the CEO job. So it was around February of 2010 is when we all sat with Stephen Hawking.
And the rest is cosmic history. Just a bit more about Dr. Hawking. The fact that this guy was an outstanding scientist, made contributions to physics that, who knows, may last forever. But he was also somebody who very much wanted to share science with others.
He did. And if you ever read his book, A Brief History of Time, you can read it, and they're all English words and everything. But these ideas are enormous. I mean, it just these ideas, these steps in thought are fantastic. And I'm pretty sure if you asked him in so many words, he would say, when you're in love, you want to tell the world.
Yeah.
And he loved what he did. And of course, his circumstance was extraordinary. Physically stuck in a wheelchair, unable to speak, yet able to produce these brilliant insights about the cosmos and to communicate with us outside of his world. It's really, I know books have been written, and they should be. He's really a remarkable man.
We'll leave it there, except, of course, that we're going to go on to hearing more about his life from someone else who was there with you at that awarding of the Cosmos Award to Stephen Hawking, Lou Friedman, the co-founder of the Planetary Society that we'll be talking to in a couple of minutes here. But thank you, Bill, and safe travels.
Thank you, Matt.
He's the CEO of the Planetary Society. I want to be weightless, and I want to feel the acceleration of a rocket pressing me into my launch couch. Don't you? But space has so far been reserved for only the healthiest and wealthiest among us. That may change as we finally approach the long-awaited inauguration of suborbital flights by Virgin Galactic and others. But scores of men and women have been safely experiencing zero-G and high-Gs for decades, albeit for less than a minute at a time. Dr. Eric Viri has helped many of them through this adventure. With an MD and a PhD in physiology, Eric teaches and conducts research on the faculty at the University of California, San Diego. He's also associate director of that school's Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination, which is where I connected with him just hours before producing this week's episode. Eric Furia, I'm so grateful to you for jumping in at the last minute to join a series of conversations today about Stephen Hawking. A couple of other people, as I've told you, Bill Nye and Lou Friedman, who had experiences with him, but yours was rather unique. And it's hard to believe that it was, 11 years ago that you got a call from your friend and colleague, Peter Diamandis. What did he ask you to do?
You're quite right, Matt. It was a unique event. And it's one of those calls that I get once in a while in my life from Peter to help him out with so many of the amazing projects that he does. So this project was for the company Zero G Corporation. And through Zero G, Peter had answered the call to help Stephen Hawking experience weightlessness. He wanted to fly in space and to really show that he could do this, given the incredible challenge that he has with his body, with ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, and the essential basic paralysis of the majority of his body. But he still wanted to fly. Ultimately, to fly out into space. So the first step, as for many wannabe astronauts and the actual astronauts, is to experience weightlessness in something called parabolic flight, where an airplane is flown way up to about 32,000 feet and then gently arcs over and descends down to 24,000 feet in about 30 seconds. And in that time, the people inside experience weightlessness. As we're passing through the gravity field of Earth, it's just as if we were in outer space. And so Hawking wanted to do that, I think, both for the ability to demonstrate that people with body challenges like his could do it, but I think also for fun. The guy was just totally excited about so many things. You know, we've heard all these stories in the past week since his passing about he was such a jokester and loved, just enjoyed things. And so wanted to have fun too, and that was what Peter offered to him through Zero G and asked me to help out in working with the team to enable Hawking to do that.
So before we go on, I must say how incredibly envious I am, because not only did you get to experience weightlessness on a Zero G flight, but to do this with Stephen Hawking, my Lord.
Well, yes, it's sort of a once-in-a-lifetime experience for all of us, Hawking and everybody else on the team. So it was pretty special. I had worked as the chief medical officer with Zero G on a number of projects from the beginning, and got to fly with all kinds of cool people, and had a special chance to even fly with my wife and daughter. So I've had about 5 flights and therefore around 60 or 70 parabolas, and it's a way awesome experience. So it's been an incredible privilege.
Now, there was more to this than just a flight of fancy for Dr. Hawking and the rest of you. You wrote a paper that was published in The Lancet, one of our planet's most distinguished medical journals.
Yes, yes. Well, and that was just a very special opportunity. So you remember that the price of the really fun part of flying in weightlessness is that at the bottom, the plane has to go back up. And so in those times, you're experiencing an increase in gravity, so almost twice your normal body weight. So, of course, for Professor Hawking's very fragile body, that was really the risk of the extra weight. And so we had practice maneuvers to make sure that he was positioned comfortably. We were monitoring his body functions, his heart rate, and the oxygen in his blood. And so all of those things were going on in real time while we had him up in the weightless intervals and then down in the hyper-G intervals.
The paper is absolutely fascinating. Do you think it's safe to say that this was very likely the least healthy person ever to experience zero-G?
Well, if not the least, at least one of them, absolutely, yes. We had a big challenge. I will tell you, we all had our fingers and toes crossed through the whole flight, but we carefully designed it. The best part was that we did the parabolas one at a time. So each weightless interval we did one at a time, and the whole team had to agree that everything was good and that if they were good, then we could carry on further. So the original flight plan was actually for 6 parabolas. Professor Hawking communicated to the world through his interface, which was the camera on his glasses, that he would manipulate his face muscles to control the computer screen. But he had special staff assistants who could communicate with him sort of through facial expressions, even without the gizmos on his glasses.
Which he did not have on these flights, right?
He didn't have, that's right. And if you see the pictures, it's kind of amazing because the other unique part of the flight is the pictures of his face. And he's got this big friggin' grin on his face. He's just so happy. And in fact, that's what was going on. So one by one, we did the 6 parabolas. And then his staff came to us at the end of the 6 and he says, no, I want to keep going. I want more. So we actually did 2 extra parabolas just at his request because everything was going well and he had asked for it. So the guy was just having a blast.
Of course, it's dangerous to draw conclusions from a sample of one.
Yes.
But based on how he tolerated and even enjoyed this experience, does this say anything to you? Does it give you hope for people who are maybe not the most perfect of human specimens that the rest of us might be able to enjoy spaceflight?
Well, absolutely. And so that's going to be the challenge for all these commercial flight operators that are coming up to offer spaceflight experiences. It would have been a very big challenge for any of the operations that we see now for Professor Hawking to actually fly into orbit around the Earth. And the main reason is that coming back is a pretty substantial G load for a little while. So it's on the order of about 4G. So again, now 4 times your body weight for maybe a minute or a few minutes. That's a much bigger stressor than we have on the zero G flights with our hyper G intervals there.
Thank you, Eric. I really am very grateful to you for sharing this experience with us and congratulate you on having gained this tremendous memory of Dr. Stephen Hawking.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for the chance to talk about it.
We've been talking with Eric Veery. He is Associate Director of the Arthur C. Clarke Center for Human Imagination at the University of California, San Diego. I'm a big fan of the center and a listener to its podcast, Into the Impossible, which I recommend. His home department at UCSD is neurosciences, but he's also in the departments of surgery, cognitive science, and at the Institute for Engineering in Medicine. And he has served as medical director of the Qualcomm Tricorder XPRIZE and the related Nokia Sensing X Challenge. This is Planetary Radio.
Hello, I'm Robert Picardo, Planetary Society board member and now the host of the Society's Planetary Post video newsletter. There's a new edition every month. We've already gone behind the scenes at JPL, partied at Yuri's Night, and visited with CEO Bill Nye. We've also got the month's top headlines from around the solar system. You can sign up at planetary.org/connect. When you do, you'll be among the first to see each new show. I hope you'll join us.
Hey, Planetary Radio listeners, the Planetary Society now has an official online store. We've teamed up with Chop Shop, known for their space mission posters, to bring you space-inspired art and merchandise. You can find exclusive Planetary Society t-shirts, posters, and more. Visit planetly/spaceshop to learn more. That's planet.ly/spaceshop.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. Louis Friedman was my boss at the Planetary Society for many years. He co-founded the Society with Carl Sagan and Bruce Murray and served as its executive director before handing the reins to Bill Nye. He's also a planetary scientist and engineer and a tireless advancer of space exploration and science. I knew Lou was one of the people behind giving the Planetary Society's Cosmos Award to Stephen Hawking, but I did not know the depth of interaction the two men enjoyed over many years. Lou, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Matt.
I'm sorry the circumstances aren't better, but this is a celebration, not too sad of a memorial for Stephen Hawking. We already heard Bill Nye met him. I assume when you also got to see him at the award of the Planetary Society's Cosmos Award. But you were just telling me that you interacted with Dr. Hawking other times.
Yeah, I've had several meetings with him. Of course, you know, he comes to Caltech, or he came to Caltech every year as part of his work. He worked closely with some of the astrophysicists there, and in particular with Kip Thorne, who I've long been friendly with and even did a little with back in the day.
Who I invited to be on this show, but he
Kip
he
is very hard to get.
He is.
Very
he's
busy
a tough guy. Big movie producer, yeah. Physicist, that's what he is.
And especially since Interstellar, but even, and especially now, because everybody knows he was Stephen Hawking's principal scientific contact, at least for many of the many things here. I was asked on behalf of the Planetary Society to introduce Stephen Hawking at a Beckman Auditorium Caltech program. Actually, the Planetary Society was co-sponsor of that program. So Stephen had spoken at one of our programs even before the Cosmos Award. And I was at the microphone at Beckman Auditorium to introduce him, but he wasn't there yet. He was over in the dining hall at the Athenaeum, and his group was having a VIP dinner, which I wasn't invited to. Not that that bothered me, of course.
It should have.
So I was told to go out on the stage and just keep the crowd entertained until he came in. And so here is everybody waiting to see Hawking, and they got me to just kind of prattle up there on the stage. And then Hawking came in, and he came in from the back through the main entrance in his wheelchair coming down the aisle. And I said, "Oh, ladies and gentlemen, here is the man who has written the explanation about what time is and the whole history of time. I'm sorry he's late. He didn't get that part right." And I think Stephen was mildly amused at that, although he couldn't instantly respond. That was my first actual personal interaction with him. We talked a little bit after that program. I met him two or three times afterwards during his visits here to Caltech, and even once had lunch with him at his temporary home that he was staying at here. But the big interaction we had with him was the one you mentioned, of course. That was very, very special. Planetary Society giving him the Cosmos Award. I don't know if you know, but and the intent was to give him that award during one of his visits here at Caltech. And we had kind of talked to both his people and the Caltech people about a date, and we'd have a big public event at Beckman Auditorium. But he became ill that year, and he couldn't travel. We had to call off our plans, and in the discussions we had at the board meeting, we said, well, you know, we could go there and present the award to him. If he can't travel, why don't we offer to go there and present the award, and we can do a lot of publicity with it. We won't have the same size event, because mm-hmm. we're going to do it right at the Cambridge University, and we don't have quite the logistics that we had here. But that's where the idea was born for several of us board members to troop off to Cambridge to give him the award. And we did have a very, very nice event, a public event, which we spoke about the future exploration of Mars. Not only was Stephen there, but Sir Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal of Britain at the time, and several other notables were there. And, of course, the board members of the Planetary Society were there.
And I just watched this video, rewatched it. Mm-hmm. There is a YouTube video, which we will provide a link to on this week's show page that people can reach from planetary.org/radio. And there were the typically eloquent Andrewian and Neil deGrasse Tyson talking about what it means, why they were so pleased to be giving this award. You were standing there beaming. You were holding the heavy award during all of this.
Yeah, that's my job. Right. I do the heavy lifting. He did bring these subjects, including time, including space, questions of the origin of the universe and the fundamental physics, to a level of popular attention that engaged people so strongly. And he tried to even do it with kids, as with his daughter writing children's books. that's why he was so deserving of the Cosmos Award. He did bring it to public presentation of science.
And clearly, he shared that sense of wonder that he had, that so many of us have. It's why we do this, even if it's, we concentrate on planetary science. Now and then I get to talk about cosmology on the radio show, but it's all of one nature, I think, isn't it? And that was so much of what the society has been about.
I remember Carl and Bruce and I in a meeting, not in this building, but in a former building.
It's Carl Sagan and Bruce Murray, of course, your fellow co-founders.
And they're talking, why do we so interested in these things? And they're all part of the same question. We're looking for ourselves out there. We are trying to understand our relationship with everything. And so it is all the same question. You're quite right. There's another remarkable aspect of Stephen that I want to comment on, which, of course, he lived in a robotic world in many respects, of course. And his participation in the real world was, to some extent, virtual. He had to get a lot of input from a lot of sensors, and he had a lot of interaction with it. Of course, he existed in the real world. It's a subject I've been interested in now for a number of years, about thinking about the future of exploration. Will the future of human exploration involve us physically in having to climb mountains or trek through deserts or do what we typically think of as human exploration? Or will it be by sitting in chairs and getting our data through all of the sensory inputs? And what Stephen has taught us in some way is, yes, we can do that. And for him, it was as much a human adventure as it is for astronauts who jumped around on the moon. Now, it is true that this man also was not satisfied with that. He wanted to participate in real exploration. Mm-hmm. He believed that humans should go to Mars, humans should colonize Mars. He thought it was necessary for the survival of Earth that humans set up and live as a multi-planet species. He was not saying that the whole future of exploration will be robotic, but just the opposite. He was a very strong advocate of humans exploring other worlds. Geniuses in general are not singular dimension people. They have multi-dimensions.
Yeah. And you've known a few.
Yeah. I've been very fortunate to the people I've gotten to know, yes.
Lou, thank you. I am glad that you were available to share some of these memories, these reminiscences of Stephen Hawking. You have provided a dimension that I have not heard from anyone else, and so I'm very grateful.
Well, I appreciate that, Matt, because he connected with the Planetary Society, and that's one of the joys that I have personally, is that I had these connections in the Planetary Society. We were able to deal with people like Carl Sagan and many others, but with Stephen Hawking, it added a whole personal element that I'm very pleased with. Thank you.
That's Lou Friedman, co-founder of the Planetary Society and our executive director emeritus, involved with many, many other things, including solar sailing. He wrote the book. Check it out. He's also the guy who once upon a time gave the go-ahead to a space geek to do a radio show and now a podcast about space exploration and planetary science. So thank you, Lou.
Okay, well, some people told me at the time, oh, that's old technology. We don't want to get involved with that. But you hung in there, and now it's new technology.
Yeah,
you're doing great.
Everything comes around.
Right.
Time for What's Up with Dr. Bruce Betts, the chief scientist for the Planetary Society, which has not made him immune from catching some crud while he was off doing business for the society last week. Welcome, poor guy.
Thanks. Yeah, ironically, I spent a lot of time in clean rooms.
But you did get to see Lightsail get packed up and then unpacked, right?
Yeah, it was very cool. So I got to see first it put into the Peapod deployer mechanism at Cal Poly, and then all of that put into the Prox 1 spacecraft. They were integrated at Air Force Research Laboratory in Albuquerque, New Mexico. So it was fascinating. It was very involved and laborious to put a box in a box in a box. Turns out there's a lot involved in doing that to make sure things work.
I especially loved your description of how they had to put glue over every screw to make extra sure that they wouldn't be shaken loose. So more proof that space is hard. I don't want to keep you going longer than you need to. We can talk about light sail, and we will another time. Tell us about the night sky.
All right. Well, it's a planet party in the sky. You got Venus low in the west looking super bright in the evening sky shortly after sunset. I'll just go ahead and stumble over words, if you don't mind, in a delirious days of lack of sleep and coughing. And then in the later evening, or you've got Jupiter coming up in the east around 11 or midnight, and then you've got Saturn and Mars getting closer and closer together. They're coming up around 2 or 3 in the morning, being seen in the pre-dawn east or south. They are similar in brightness, Mars being the reddish one, Saturn being the yellowish one, and they will get quite close on April 2nd. All right, we move on to this week in space history. It was 2001 that the controlled deorbit of the Mir space station happened, coming in and burning up, plunking in the South Pacific Ocean.
Wow, and now we've got the Chinese space station entering, I've been told, early April, first week of April, maybe. We may be talking to somebody about that soon.
Mir was a bigger beast. We'll be talking more about Mir because I can't help myself. It's a thematic show, and we're going to move on to random space fact.
Don't strain yourself.
I decided not to. The Mir space station operated in orbit from 1986 to 2001. It was the first modular space station. So in other words, made up of different components, like International Space Station was assembled later on.
Nice work.
We move on to the trivia question. I asked you how many missions carried humans to space as part of the NASA Mercury program. How'd we do, Matt?
It was Jeff Sellers who was chosen by random.org. He is a past winner. We don't get a lot, actually, but he won about 2.5 years ago, and his time may have come again. He says, there were 6 total Mercury flights with 6 astronauts flown, no room for anybody else in there. Total flight time for these missions, 53 hours, 55 minutes, and 27 seconds, correct?
Yes, indeed.
Jeff, congratulations. You have won yourself a Planetary Society t-shirt and a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account. Without further ado, on to the next contest.
How many space shuttle flights docked with the Mir space station? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Oh, excellent question. And you have until March 28th, Wednesday the 28th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to answer this one and win yourself a beautiful Planetary Society t-shirt intersecting Mars and Earth with the Planetary Society at the intersection. You can see it at chopshopstore.com in the Planetary Society store there. And a 200-point iTelescope.net astronomy account on that worldwide network of telescopes operated out of Australia, where we have so many listeners that we love.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about health.
Good Lord. Please send your best cold remedies to planetaryradio@planetary.org. Care of Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society, who joins us every week here for What's Up. Ad Astra. It means to the stars, and it has meant so much to me for many years. So in this time of growth for our show, I'm going to close it with that heartfelt wish for all of us. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by its globe-spanning members. Mary Liz Bender is our associate producer. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. I'm Matt Kaplan. Ad Astra.